So how do you feel about hunting? Is it something you remember doing with a grandfather or uncle, a kid's pursuit that has gone by the wayside in a new and busier world? Or is it a luxurious getaway, best launched from a lodge on the plains, each day culminating in a rich dinner and time in the hot tub? Is hunting something you've always wanted to try but have no idea where to start? Or does the very thought of it disgust you? Well, chances are, hunting is not for you what it is for our guest today, nothing less than a way of life. Stephen Ranella is a writer and an outdoorsman. He's host of the television show Meat Eater on the Sportsman Channel and has a new book out of the same name. He joins us this morning from his home in Brooklyn, New York. Stephen Ranella, welcome to Up to Date.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
And I apologize to you and our listeners for the winter cold voice that I'm inflicting on you this morning. So let me ask.
Oh, I like it. It gives you that nice soothing radio sound.
Yeah, kind of a rugged, outdoorsy sort of feel for the topic today. So what's the last thing you hunted? Where and when and how'd it go?
The last thing I hunted was, you know, it's funny you bring it up because I'm in the process of turning some into some sausage right now. The last thing I hunted was mule deer.
All right.
In Montana. I have family in Montana. I lived there a long time. So one of my favorite things to do, something I never miss, is to go out and hunt the rut, you know, like the peak of the breeding season for mule deer. And so I'm just kind of coming off that now.
Very good. Well, so I want to talk today about certainly your television program, your book, but really want to talk about hunting, which you are an unabashed, unapologetic advocate for hunting and its place in society. But you actually say pretty early in your book, you offer some statistics which you find pretty disturbing. You say that there are fewer hunters on Earth now than there have been at any other time in human history.
That's right. Yeah, a lower percentage, you know, a lower percentage of hunting. And, you know, right now, 95% of American adults do not hunt. There was a slight tick in the last few years, oddly, a slight uptick in hunter numbers in the last few years. Not in a per capita sense, but just in pure numbers, a slight uptick.
And why do you think
we have,
that is?
We have, like, way more golfers. We have way more golfers than hunters in this country.
Okay,
particularly disturbing.
But especially if you're not a golfer, right? But you know, when you golf, there's not a lot of blood around. Generally you're not doing it in the cold. I mean,
it's very sanitized, very comfortable.
So why don't people hunt?
You know, I think that there's probably like a lot of reasons that would be sociological in nature. You know, there was some turning point recently when we became a predominantly urban nation where most people live in cities rather than, you know, living in the countryside. Also, I think that if you look at immigration and things, I mean, people are moving here from places where hunting really hasn't been something that's gone on in their culture, due to, you know, issues such as overcrowding, of not having the pristine environments that we have here in the U.S., so they might not come here as hunters. I think also it's just one of the things that humans, as we look at just the evolution of society or human progression, it's just one of those things that gets kind of cast aside, similar to, you know, and similar to producing our own food, similar to how many of us take place, you know, participate in agriculture. All these things, we just become a specialized society, and we go into things and get away from other things. And so I think that people have just, in some degree, have turned away from hunting, not so much by saying, like, I'm choosing not to hunt. I used to hunt, but I'm going to quit. But just by not getting into it in the first place, you know. But like I said, recently we had this little, since I published my book, the numbers came out, where we had this slight uptick in hunters. And people attribute that to all kinds of things. They attribute to the economy and various things, and it's really difficult to explain. I think in some ways it's people seizing upon this idea of self-sufficiency in food that we hear so much about now.
Well, one of the things you talk about is the fact that most people who hunt because their fathers hunted, right? It's inherited.
Yeah, I think of it as a thing of patrilineal descent. And you know, there are many, many, many notable exceptions to that, but just generally, guys have hunted because their dad hunted. I started hunting because my dad hunted. I never made a conscious decision to hunt. All I had to do was just not make a conscious decision to not hunt, and I would become a hunter. But my father, on the other hand, is one of those exceptions where his father did not hunt. He discovered it on his own. But if you look just like in a broad cultural sense around the world, hunting is generally young boys are trained as hunters by their fathers. And so in some ways, American society still reflects that.
We're going to talk with Stephen Ranella today about lots of aspects of hunting, including the different animals that he's hunted and the different ways of preparing some pretty unusual types of meat, and invite you to send your questions for Stephen Ranella to our email address, update@kcur.org. You can also post your thoughts on KCUR's Facebook page. Stephen, I'm wondering about that 5%, that dying breed that do still hunt. Do they fit a particular demographic? You've mentioned men and boys over and over already. Are they entirely men? Do they fit a particular demographic profile? Are they wealthy? Are they poor? Who hunts today?
You know, it's so hard to say because, you know, like, as you know, I mean, you know, you're a trained journalist, so you've been taught to be suspicious of generalizations, you know, but I would say generally speaking, and this is going to offend all the, you know, the people who aren't, but I would say generally speaking, hunters in this country have tended to be certainly male, though right now the fastest growing segment of the demographic in American hunters is women, but they've been traditionally male, traditionally rural. It's been more of a blue collar thing. You find the opposite in Europe, like in Scotland, it's upper class. For a long time, they didn't spell it out this way, but it was essentially illegal for poor people to hunt in Europe. I mean, you know, there's elements of that captured in the Robin Hood story where the poor person has to go out and poach food. You know, he has to poach food for the poor because the rich have it all locked up.
Because it's on their land. Yeah, you had to have land to hunt.
Yeah, here it's been like it's a kind of traditionally a working class pursuit. But again, a lot of that's changing because, like I said, we now have the fastest growing segment of the demographic is women hunters. We have, and this is more like guy down the street anecdotal things, but I have so many guys now, guys and women, from urban backgrounds who are getting interested in hunting and they're coming at it from a food angle. You know, the same thing that might push someone to experiment and go buy a side of pork and then come home and try to make their own sausages, their own cured meats, are now being like, I'm going to take that one step further and go out and get a deer and kill that deer myself and hunt that deer myself and then make my own food for that. So there's like an experimental element of urban people. But again, like I just want to reiterate that, again, traditionally that has not been the case. It's been rural, male, middle class, blue collar pursuit because those are the people who have had access to hunting lands, access to hunting grounds.
You actually go in your book way back in the history of hunting. I mean, way, way back. How far back in human history do we have records of people hunting?
You know, it's so impossible to say because there's debate that, you know, we started eating meat 3 and 4 million years ago, you know, way before human forms, like way before we were a recognizable human form. You start seeing very sophisticated sets of tools, stone implements and spear points and things that are clearly hunting equipment before modern human forms. People making sharpened blades and axes and stuff. As far as like throwing spears and being specialized big game hunters, certainly by 50 or 60,000 years ago during the African diaspora when modern humans were leaving Africa to go out and colonize the world, you know, at an astonishingly rapid pace, they were specialized big game hunters. And being a specialized big game hunter enabled our ancestors, our early human ancestors, to flourish the way they did because they were moving across unfamiliar landscapes. When they went through Siberia and down to northern Alaska, they were moving across very frigid landscapes where foraging and any kind of like agricultural-based practices, you know, were non-existent at the time. And they needed to be able to travel and kill meat in unfamiliar localities. And so by then you have a really strong backbone of big game hunting. And at the time of European contact here, I mean, people arrived here in North America, you know, 13 or 14,000 years ago, certainly were big game hunters. And at the time of European contact, big game hunting and hunting in general was almost fundamental to the Native American tribe. Sure, you had a lot of agriculture mixed in here and there in certain areas, but hunting was still something that affected every person. You know, every person derived benefits from the activity of hunting at that time. And then since then, it's been hunting has been slowly marginalized as a lifestyle.
I guess I'm wondering how comparable you think those ancient practices are, not even all that ancient, where hunting is for sustenance, it is for food, how comparable that is to what we talk about as hunting today, which is very frequently for sport.
Yeah, well, we have options now. So that's why, like, I'm always careful to use the phrase lifestyle, you know, because it's a lifestyle choice that I make. And I could never sit here and argue and tell you that, oh, if I didn't hunt, I wouldn't eat. But there are some interesting parallels to that in American history, where there were times when, you know, when Europeans came here and missionaries would go out and make contact with Native American tribes, they'd be like, why can't you people get with the program? You know, you're living like savages. Why do you want to go out and hunt? You could raise vegetables and farm. And they certainly could. Like, they could have gone and got with that program and gone and lived on a reservation and lived off agricultural products and not hunted. But something about the hunting lifestyle, it was in their blood. It was their culture. And they chose to pursue it. In that way, I think that it's similar where it is. It's like, to hunt now is a similar form of insurgency. I don't mean to equate hunting today to being like, I mean to literally equate it to what it might go on to be a Native American, you know, being subjected to reservation confinement. Like, I certainly don't want to sound that way. But people have always made the choice to live a hunter-gatherer existence in face of other options, you know. And so now we live in a place where this country, we enjoy very, very stable game populations, and game is managed on a state level. All 50 states do a phenomenal job of maintaining wild game populations and regulating hunting in perpetuity. So we'll always have wild game at the current rates. And it's a good lifestyle to live. I would never argue that every American could go out and start hunting, because if every American went out and killed a deer, we'd have a deficit of, you know, a couple hundred million deer.
Right.
It's just not plausible. But those of us who choose to live this way, I think it's a great way to live, and I think it has a lot of rewards.
We're talking with Stephen Ranella, who's the author of the book Meat Eater. He hosts a show of the same name on the Sportsman Channel, and we want to bring our listeners into the conversation. Are you a hunter? Why do you do it? What's the thrill of hunting for you? And if you aren't a hunter, why not? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. Join our conversation about hunting, 235-2888, or email us at updatedate@kcur.org. You know, you said, Stephen, that you don't have to hunt to eat, of course, but you actually avoid buying meat, right? You primarily live on the food that you hunt. Is that right?
Yeah, I started out hunting. You know, I can't even tell you when I began hunting. It was so young. You know, I would fish. You know, ever since I remember, I know I could, like, manage my own rod and catch my own fish. When I was 3, was hunting small game at 7, 8 years old. Killed my first deer at 13. So I always grew up around wild game. But we ate a mixed diet. We ate wild game and we ate domestic meats. In fact, we had separate freezers for them. It was like, in our household, it was strange. You know, like we had a freezer that would be some chicken and beef burgers and stuff, and then we had a freezer that was full of wild game, and it was the game freezer. So we had that sort of plurality of foods. And at the same time, I trapped a lot, and I trapped and sold, you know, muskrats and minks and raccoons and sold furs into the fur market. So I wasn't trapping for meat, but I was trapping for money. Mm-hmm. Now, by the time I moved away to college and started just living on wild game, like, when I went away to college, I lived with a couple guys, and the three of us, I remember one time, ate 4 deer between October 1st and Christmas break. And that was out of necessity then, because we were just like the classic story of, like, college kids with no money. It was just easier for us to eat deer meat than it was to eat other stuff. We had more time than we had money. Hmm. At that point, I just said, this is when I was about 22 years old, I decided, from now on, I'm just going to eat a wild game diet at my home. You know, I will only in my home consume game. One, because I love to hunt. And so if I have access to the stuff, I might as well eat it. Two, because it's just more rewarding to me to have it be that I went out and procured my meals on my own and took those items from A to Z. And every meal becomes a story. It becomes a moment of pride for me. And now that I'm married, I have one child, another child on the way. And when they're in the home, they eat wild game. So it's just better. It works better for us. And the bar for me has shifted, where now for me, game is normal. For me to go and eat like a greasy hamburger, It just seems off to me, you know, and I've over time trained myself that way to savor wild game, and it allows me to do what I love to do. Like, if for hunting for me is about adventure, and it's about food. If you removed either of those things from it, the structure would crumble. You know, I have to have both elements for me to enjoy it.
We're talking with Stephen Ranella about Meat Eater and about his life as a hunter. 816-235-2888 is the number to call if you want to join the conversation. Joe in Leawood has done that. Joe, good morning and welcome to Up to Date.
Well, good morning, and I apologize, too, because I've got a bit of the same kind of cold you're going around with.
Welcome to the club.
But I'm a kind of a late-in-life hunter, and it's really, I find it really interesting. There's been a couple of things that I've really got in, you know, got out of it is I think I'd encourage a lot of people that are even curious about it to do it just because there's an honesty to it, to going out and pursuing an animal and taking it and eating it. And you actually understand what the life cycle is. And the second thing is you also get to experience, I kind of work in a professional area in Kansas City area. It's really different to go out. Like, I just came back this weekend. I was on the Colorado-Kansas border, and we're out after some quail and prairie dogs. And to see, you know, what happens when you have rodents, pests, they're out of control. And, you know, there's nobody, no predation on them. And also just to kind of go out and see what the rural America is dealing with in the drought.
Appreciate the call, Joe.
Thanks.
You know, I was interested, Stephen, in your story of your wife, how she discovered what it is with you and hunting, as she put it, which she discovered when she was actually saving up breast milk in the freezer. Tell us a little about how that discovery was made.
Yeah, so my wife grew up, you know, just in Michigan, same as I did, a couple hours away from me, but she grew up in the city and just had no, you know, she always talks about how she knew one guy that hunted. You know, I mean, I couldn't have found someone that didn't hunt in my area or someone whose family didn't hunt. So we grew up close, but just completely different upbringings. And when we met, she very seamlessly switched into that she would just eat wild game because I do the cooking in the home. And so if I cook it, she's going to eat it. It's better her just to eat it than it is to try to make it herself. So she's always been fine with it that way. But she could never really understand, like, how it was so engrossing to me or how I could be so obsessive about going hunting and coming home and preparing my meat and getting it all frozen and packaged and turning it into, you know, Lord knows how many different kind of creations until we had a baby. And our son, you know, my wife would pump milk for the baby. And, you know, you're able to pump more than the baby eats. And so you stock it away, you know, and she would put in these little bags with the boy's name on it and the date, and she would have these stacked up in the freezer if some kind of catastrophe or whatever should prevent her from being able to breastfeed the baby. We'd be able to go and, you know, give it this instead of having to give it formula. And as she was doing this and packaging these things and labeling them in sort of the same way I package and label wild game meat, it finally clicked with her, you know. And it was funny because I just remember a day in the living room where she said to me, I get it now. Like, I get that feeling of satisfaction and self-sufficiency that comes with stocking your own freezer. Through your own efforts, you know, and it's been an interesting to be married to someone who not only doesn't hunt, but is almost kind of indifferent to the hunting practice has been interesting to me. And in some ways, in writing my book, it was a response to that. If I had just stayed and lived where I grew up, I would never have thought to explain hunting because it's not something that that occurred to me would need to be explained. I would just think that everybody already knew all this stuff. But meeting people like my wife and various friends that I've met through publishing and living in cities a couple times for work, it's like I now understand the mind frame a little bit better of people who are uneasy with hunting or indifferent to it or who just have no idea about it. And so in some ways I was writing to them.
We have an email here from Gavin. I think what is keeping a lot of people from hunting is really not knowing how, right? So
that's a giant issue.
So Gavin wrote us with this question. My grandfathers hunted, but my parents did not. Consequently, I never learned a skill that I think is important to how we think about and get our food. But where do you begin? My guess is that most hunters wouldn't want to drag a novice along on a hunt. So if you're completely new to it, how do you learn, short of stumbling around with a gun in the field?
You know, I try to do a lot for a field we call hunter recruitment. And the motivations on hunters' parts, to answer the question, why would a hunter bring a novice out into the field, is I would say, I would reference a statistic I threw at you earlier, about 95% of American adults not hunting. And we live in a democracy, you know, and non-hunters, if they don't have a favorable impression of hunting, are just going to kill us in the legislature. I mean, you see it in California, it happens all the time. Like more and more in California, they whittle away at hunters' rights, not in like science-based issues, but just like people coming to the emotional decision that it's wrong to hunt for animals, and so they make it more and more difficult there to do so. So in that way, hunters, just in, as an act of self-preservation, hunters have an obligation to take non-hunters out and try to instruct them in the ways of the hunter. It's extremely difficult to learn how to hunt.
So Gavin,
should show you the skills and places.
Gavin shouldn't be afraid to ask someone to help him.
No, because if they tell him no, they're wrong.
We're going to take a little break and continue our conversation in a moment with Stephen Ranella, author of Meat Eater. We're going to talk about meat and about the taste of meat and different kinds of meat and what's so advantageous about meat that comes from hunting. We'll also talk about some of the concerns out there, concerns from vegetarians or folks concerned about animal cruelty and how someone who has spent a life in hunting might respond to all that. If you want to join the conversation, call us at 816-235-2888, 235-2888. You can also email us at uptodate@kcur.org or post comments on our Facebook page. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. If you missed Steve's conversations on Friday with the Prairie Village art collector Topper Johns or tenor Nathan Graner, you can find those and all our other previous broadcasts at kcur.org. On tomorrow's program, we'll be broadcasting live from the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts, where this year's City Age Summit on the New American City is taking place. Join us there for some great conversations on technology, urban planning, and the future of our nation's urban centers. We hope you'll join us tomorrow. But today, we're talking with Stephen Ranella about his book, Meat Eater, Adventures from the Life of an American Hunter, and about the phenomenon that is hunting in America. You can join the conversation by emailing us at uptodate@kcur.org. I want to talk next, Stephen, about the meat that you get from this hunting, because it's different than the meat that you might get at the store, right? Let's talk with Dan in St. Joe here for a minute. Dan, welcome to Up to Date.
Good morning.
So you're a hunter, I understand.
Yes, lifetime.
And
family,
why?
Well, one raised that way. My grandfather kept a family of 15 children alive through the Great Depression by hunting and fishing.
So you really were a sustenance hunter, your family was.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's just been passed down through generations. Certain family members disdained it, didn't care for it, but we're here because of hunting.
I understand that some of your motivation, though, for hunting is about the meat that you get from the hunting, right?
Oh, the quality. I've never gotten sick from meat that I've hunted and I've processed, because I've been taught how to respect the meat. You don't go out and kill something and then mistreat it, you know, as far as the handling or anything like that. You don't make a kill unless you can make a clean kill. The animals that I harvest are collected very humanely and processed and cleaned. And they don't have a chance to pick up E. coli. I never had that problem. Never have had, and I trust never will.
Well, okay. Let me ask our guest about that, Stephen Ranella. What is it true that hunted meat is better, healthier than store meat?
Well, I mean, just if you look at it, you know, in kind of a numerical sense, it certainly is far lower in cholesterol than grain-fed, grain-fattened domestic meat. In my mind, it's much safer because I do all my own processing. So I'm able to follow the history of an animal from the time I harvest it to the time it winds up in my home. But beyond that, but I can't sit and tell you that I only hunt for reasons of food safety. I look at those as being side benefits because I also just prefer the taste of meat. I think that if you have an adventurous palate, you'll find that a lot of domestically produced meats are just kind of bland. And I think that wild game meats are more adventurous and more varied than anything you're going to find in a grocery store, especially if you don't live in a large urban area that can drive a lot of, you know, ethnic foods and ethnic preparations and things.
Right.
So yeah, for me, it's safety. And I much prefer to give wild game to my young son because I know that wild game was handled very well, and we don't have to worry about some of the issues and some of the food scares that you see popping up from large commercial ground meat operations and low grade stuff that winds up in hamburger restaurants. It's just not even on my mind.
How old is your son?
2.5.
So we've got suburban parents in shock all across the listening area now.
He'll be eating mule deer for dinner tonight, in fact. So
one of my favorite parts of your book actually is the tasting notes sections, where you really come out of your shell as a lover of all kinds of meat, where you share the things that people need to know about the taste of different meats, which I suspect are often meats they have not tasted before. So let me ask you for some quick summaries. What do people need to know about the taste of black bear?
I think about black bear, they need to know it's the closest they can come to replicating a pork-like meat with wild game, outside of course, wild pigs. And also it's important to know what the black bear has been consuming. I know of no other animal whose flesh represents their diet more accurately than black bear. And if you've got bears that have been feeding on dead fish, you're going to want to steer clear of that. If you're lucky enough to get bears that have been feeding on blueberries, apples, corn, or just simply grass, you're in for a much better, more meat that's almost equivalent to good grass-fed beef. And also the fat on bears, if they're eating on blueberries, is phenomenal for making your own lard, and I use that for my own pie crust and stuff like that.
Yeah, actually, your most recent blog post, I noted, was on how to render bear fat, which I can't imagine
exactly.
I've ever read a blog post on that subject.
I have jars of that stuff in my fridge.
How about tasting beaver? What do we need to know about the taste of beaver?
Well, an old, mid-1800s delicacy is beaver tail. And it took me a long time to figure out how they ate this. But the guys we call the mountain men, so like the Rocky Mountain beaver trappers in the 1820s, 1830s, would always be eating beaver tail. And it really is the tail. So like the flat, scaly, black tail on a beaver has inside of it a fat that is reminiscent of gristle on steak. It's not a spreadable fat, but it's a chewy fat. And if you roast that beaver tail until the skin starts to bubble and peel away, and then you scrape that skin away, it's particularly if you've had a diet where you eat a lot of game meat, which is so lean, and you get almost a craving for fat now and then, it's the next best thing to butter that I've ever discovered.
Wow.
Is that beaver tail fat. And also, the back hams on the beaver can be cooked like pot roast. And it winds up, the meat has breaks in a grain that is almost, that kind of reminds you of the grain on brisket. And it has a very pleasant, almost kind of perfumed taste because beavers have castor, and it's an ingredient that was often used in perfume. And that can be detected in the meat, and it's a very unusual taste. But most people, especially, you know, people who are open-minded diners, think that it's quite pleasant.
Hmm. So it's interesting to me that although your book is called Meat Eater, it's not just the meat of the animal that is so valuable.
No, I eat a lot of organs. I'll eat, just recently we were eating kidneys out of mule deer. I eat liver, I eat heart. I've eaten everything from brains to lungs to testicles off animals, and I dine it all. And again, that is an ancient practice where if you eat a diet of lean red meat, like wild game, you can wind up with even some kind of like, you can have like a low calorie intake and have nutrient deficiencies. So the practice would be, if you look at indigenous cultures, to often eat as many of the soft tissues and organ meats and all, even liquids. So I've eaten, I've tried bile, which used to be something people would eat. I've eaten the blood. And so I experiment with these things. And a lot of times you find real hidden treasures, like things that have fallen away from modern American dining that you almost can't explain why they had. I do not understand why kidneys and eggs is something that people have just decided to stop eating all of a sudden. I think it's fantastic, and I wouldn't know about that if it weren't for hunting, because I wouldn't have such a richness of ingredients at my disposal.
Well, for any listeners we still have, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison. We're talking with Stephen Ranella about meat and about hunting. We're going to talk a little bit about the ethics of hunting, and let's take a call from Ted in Kansas City, Missouri. Ted, good morning.
Good morning, guys. How you doing?
Doing well.
The reason I called was it's something that's happening in Kansas City soon that has been controversial for the last few years. First, I'll say that I'm not a hunter. I don't have any problem with hunting as long as you're going to eat what you kill. I find trophy hunting to be abhorrent. The idea of taking down a beautiful animal to make an object out of it just seems awful to me and not true to the sense of it. But, Stephen, here in Kansas City, we have a park, Shawnee Mission Park, and as of a few years ago, it had about four times as many deer as was healthy. Destroying the habitat, driving out other animals, and they were encroaching into neighborhoods to forage because they're running out of food. And so the city came up with a plan to cull the herd, and I thought, great idea. But there was this huge outcry from the city of people who thought this was cruel and weren't taking into account how the environment needs to be balanced. So I thought maybe you could address that hunting is important to keep other animals healthy, as opposed to it's bad to kill Bambi.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, when it comes to game management, I think you have to keep in mind that we live in a, you know, like, we can't really pretend that we live in a completely natural environment anymore. I mean, the influence of humans is felt so widely and so universally across the landscape that we're going to have to be active players on all ends of it. And if we have more white-tailed deer in this country now than at the time of European contact, far more. And when we create little sanctuaries for them, like places like parks and things, we often have removed predation from those herds, and we've given them artificial food sources. So it might be irrigated grasslands, landscaping, things they would never have access to. And you do, you get these elevated populations that would never be sustainable in a truly wild ecosystem, and you have to then make a decision. I mean, you know, it's a controversial political decision because you have to decide we're going to go in there and mechanically remove some of these animals. The alternative would be you wait until something like blue tongue or communicable disease comes in, and it'll carry off typically, you know, 75-80% of that herd. So it's kind of a some now or all later situation. In my mind, when I hear of a situation like that, I always prefer to hear that they're allowing for hunters to go in and do the harvesting. Some places, I know some municipalities in New Jersey have just hired sharpshooters to go at night and shoot them and then throw them on a landfill. That's another way, because it's more palatable to people to not have to see this going on. But to me, that seems incredibly wasteful. And if the residents of your city, these urban areas, can go out and harvest these animals and use the meat responsibly and wisely, I think that it's preferable to me than just going down to a grocery store and buying beef that you don't know where it came from. But, you know, that almost goes outside of hunting and becomes into something like managing people and wildlife.
Right. And indeed, in this case, they were killed not by hunters. They were not – licenses were not granted. They were given – sharpshooters actually came in and professionally called the herd. So,
yeah, and, you know, to me, it's like that – you know, it's just so far removed from anything, any aspect of hunting that I know about, you know. And I hate to comment too deeply on it because I don't know what they wound up doing with that meat. But I can just assure you there are a lot of hunters out there that would love to have had access to that venison.
I'm wondering how you respond, Stephen, to those who sort of raise ethical questions about hunting. And I'm thinking of those who would say, look, people have guns and weapons. The deer or the other animals don't have that. It's not really a fair fight. Others might raise concerns about the fact that animals suffer pain in the course of being hunted before they die. How do you respond to that? How do you deal with that personally as someone who hunts?
Yeah, I would say they're definitely right that it's a fair fight. Like, I've never felt that my life was in danger by deer. We're talking about deer specifically. Other animals, it's a slightly different story. But yeah, I mean, the odds, and I don't really know how to respond to it because the odds are so obviously stacked in the hunter's favor. I think that that's probably true with all predation. I mean, if you look at a wolf, you know, generally a wolf is not that worried about getting killed by a deer. So when we consume things, we're not really, us and, you know, other species, any other predatory animal I can think of, none of us are really going out trying to handicap ourselves and increase the chances that we might be injured by our prey. It's just not something that predators really think about. But if someone's come to the decision that they've decided, they've looked at all the facts, and they decided that it's morally wrong, unethical, to take animal life for the betterment of human life, and they live that way in a whole way, you know, and they don't buy meat from the store, and, you know, they don't wear leather. And I almost want to say I congratulate them, not for the decision they made, but just for the consistency. It's not easy to be vegan in this society. And if you can do it and you can handle that the inconvenience of it, and you're that strong morally, I would actually rather have you over for dinner. I mean, I'm talking about like a staunch vegan over for dinner, and I'll cook them whatever they'd like to eat, rather than have someone over who claims to be an anti-hunter, but then who buys meat from the store because they think that it's morally okay to eat meat. They just have no idea where it came from. They don't, no idea how it was raised. It just magically appears in front of them. Like, that level of hypocrisy is so distasteful to me. But just coming to the decision that you don't want to end animal life is not distasteful to me. I can understand where those people are coming from. I've just looked at it. I've looked at the history of wildlife conservation. I've looked at human history, and I've come to a different set of beliefs. Typically, species will, you know, all life requires other life to end. And even if you do eat a vegan existence, you talk about animal violence, there's really no greater violence against the landscape than to go in and make a soybean monoculture in a field. You're ending all chance that that field will ever produce anything besides one species. And a hunter cherishes biodiversity. You know, we want an abundance of animals and a variety of animals on the landscape, and that's why the lead conservation organizations in this country have always been funded by hunters.
Yeah, Allison wrote us an email, and she talks about her husband being an avid hunter. They eat everything he kills, and she agrees with you about the sense of self-sufficiency that hunting gives the family. She wants to know how hunters are actually helping wildlife by buying hunting licenses and duck stamps and such, because the system is set up in such a way that it is supposed to help the animal population, right?
Yeah, so we have basically self-imposed excise taxes. We have excise taxes on sporting goods like guns and ammunition, archery equipment, camping equipment that are federally earmarked for wildlife research, wildlife habitat restoration, wildlife enforcement. Every year right now, hunters are kicking in about $250 million that go into these things. There is no similar vegan or vegetarian tax. You know, this is something that hunters have to – we're footing the bill for this on our own. Also, the most effective non-governmental conservation organizations, such as Ducks Unlimited, National Wild Turkey Federation, Boone and Crockett Club, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership – I could go on and on and on – are hunter-funded through donation and through membership fees. And they do the real work of land acquisition and habitat preservation. It's ludicrous to act like the only – if hunting ended, it's ludicrous to think that the only thing it would mean would be that there would be fewer deer getting shot out in fields. If hunting were to end, you would be ending what is now an almost 100-year legacy of wildlife conservation and landscape preservation that is to, you know, that is responsible for some of our greatest conservation gains we have. Like I said, right now we have more deer – and more turkeys than at the time of European contact. And those are the two most hunted large animals in this country. So if you look at that scenario, you can kind of see in black and white sense where I'm coming from on this.
Stephen, we have just a couple minutes left. I want to ask a couple of questions about you, actually. I'm kind of sort of interested in this world you live in. You write for Salon and The New Yorker and The New York Times. Here you are giving an interview on an NPR station. You live in Brooklyn. But you're an outdoorsman. You're known for hunting and eating meat. How do you bridge these sort of two cultural worlds that people see sometimes as being very separate?
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, I hunt. You know, I've lived in a lot of other places, lived in Montana and Alaska and stuff, and I hunt now more than I ever did when I lived in the good hunting places. And it's just peculiar because of the industry I work in. You know, I film a hunting show and I write about hunting. So I hunt about 60 or 70% of the year. And the show I produce, like the hunting show I do, we produce it here out of New York. So I'm here and I do post-production work and things like that. But it's just peculiar. I mean, it's so peculiar to me and the line of work that I'm in that it isn't really, you know, a good way of looking at things. But I would say, it's not like replicable. You know, no one else would be able to like replicate the lifestyle that I have right now. And as far as what like you're alluding to sort of like what might be kind of the political sensibilities of different publications or news outlets that I contribute material to, I would just say that it goes to accentuate something I was trying to mention earlier, that it's really hard to make stereotypes about hunters. You know, you can give some generalities about the way things have been,
right,
but for every generality you find, you're going to find there's a lot of you know, a lot of exceptions thrown in.
Do you feel like
I think that for me to be a lifelong hunter and to be an author is an exception to the rule.
Do you feel like people who read your book, who watch your show, are themselves hunters, or are they living vicariously through you? I mean, are you giving them their hunting experience?
I think it's generally very avid hunters. I hear more from avid hunters, and I tend to hang out with and associate more with really avid hunters. And I think that's generally who's doing it, but I cherish the ones, you know, the audience members and the fans that I cherish are those who are feeling that call, you know, to be out in the wilderness and doing that call to take responsibility for their own food and are going out there for the first time. I mean, those are the ones I really love to hear from.
We had a great number of callers today. I want to apologize to David and Josh and Meredith and Aaron and David, whose calls we didn't get to. We had some great questions in the email as well. Stephen Ranella, a lot of interest. The author of Meat Eater, Adventures from the Life of an American Hunter. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, man. I appreciate it.
You can find out more information about Stephen and all our guests at KCUR.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow, a live broadcast from the Kauffman Center, where the City Age Summit on the New American City is taking place. Join us for conversations about technology, urban planning, and the future of our nation's cities. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, and Beth Lipoff. Steve Kraske is away. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date.